Well, good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning. We have a lot of folks out, as we usually do, being a young congregation. Most of our folks go elsewhere, but we have a lot of visitors too, so we're glad for that. I want to preach this morning on the Passion of Christ, and we will end that tonight. We'll tell the Jewish side of it this morning and tonight the Roman side. About every 5 to 7 years through my preaching, I've done this. I've done this once before here, but it was 6 years ago, so hard to believe that much time could pass by. But I think it's important to tell the story. And that's what we're going to do. So I have a lot of scriptures, and because we're flipping back and forth between Mark and Luke and John, because they add different aspects of it, I've printed them all up on a sheet. If you'll raise your hand, there's guys in the back that'll pass them out if you want one. If couples are couples and you're sitting next to each other, if you can use one together, then that'll allow more of them. I never know how many of them to produce. The masters are in the back in case any of y'all think you need to do some more. So I'm going to hand this one out. William Barclay writes in the letters of John and Jude on page 3 this statement: by AD 100, certain things had almost inevitably happened within the church. Many were now second or even third generation Christians. The thrill of the first days had to some extent at least passed away. In the first days of Christianity, there was a glory and a splendor, but now Christianity had become a thing of habit. Traditional, half-hearted, nominal. Boy, if it could be said of the people in AD 100, how much more so can it be said of us? The problem with us is that every first day of the week we partake of the Lord's Supper and in that remember His death. At this time of year, many religions will celebrate this day as Easter. We understand that is man-made as far as picking the day. As far as the month, we would be correct of understanding that Passover would have fallen somewhere between mid-March to mid-April. So to say at the time of the year, we know, because obviously I believe they missed it big time by putting the birth of Jesus in December. Shepherds aren't with their flocks out in the middle of the winter, and they share the same winter that we do. But the difference about when man had picked Easter to be is that at least it's targeted at the right time. That is, from mid-March on our calendars to mid-April would have been the time that the Passover would have been observed. And so Jesus would die during that feast. What we want to look at this morning then is to think about the Jewish side of it. At first, to think in the scriptures about the story beginning in the Garden of Gethsemane. We are ending instituting the Lord's Supper. He has gone around and washed the disciples' feet. He has given that great discourse that John records for us, and only John, in chapters 14, 15, 16, and 17, part of 17. And then in 18 and verse 1, the text says this: when Jesus had spoken these words, He went out with His disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which He had, and His disciples entered. To picture for you then where this is located in modern Jerusalem, the Temple Mount is, of course, where the Dome of the Rock is. Those of you that were with me Wednesday night, we've looked at this already. This is the Kidron Valley that was mentioning. It's a very deep ravine. It was 60 feet deeper at the time of the Old Testament, New Testament, than it is today. The Hinnom Valley will be down here, and then the other valley that's called the Central Valley goes up the other side. So Jerusalem was a very easily defended city from that standpoint. This is the ancient city of David, the hill would go on down here. And then the Temple Mount is here. And the retaining walls that are there, the only thing left of Herod's temple are the foundation stones. In a minute we'll show a picture of the Wailing Wall, and the modern Jews, when they pray, they are praying in front of the foundation stones of Herod's temple. But that's all that's left. All of this other stuff, of course, came through the different centuries. This is one of the third most holy sites to the Muslims. And so the Dome of the Rock. The temple actually probably stood, scholars now think, about the length of a football field north. Okay, so this is north and this is south on this side of the wall. Of course, Bethany is here. That they would have traveled over the Mount of Olives. This is this mount here between Kidron and Mount Moriah and the city, ancient city of David, is the Mount of Olives. The western wall is here. They've cleared out this area. It's the, as I said, the stones that mark, you can see some of them even on this side, they mark the base of it. Gethsemane then was on the upper side. This is traditional Gethsemane. Nobody knows for sure where the garden is. It means olive press, as you know. So there were a lot of vineyards, olive groves, those kinds of things, gardens that the citizenry of Jerusalem had on that side. This is a look at the Kidron Valley. If you can see these two little people, then you can get kind of a perspective of how deep ravine it is. And yet I said to you, it's like 60 feet higher in modern times, in our time, than it was in the days of Jesus. All right, this is a particular garden, the one that's called the Garden of Gethsemane, but there's no way that anyone knows for sure. These are olive trees, and they are ancient olive trees. The thing that's interesting about an olive tree is it has no rings, and so there's no way to determine the age of it by taking a core sample. But they know these trees date from anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 years ago, but most likely none of them are the trees that go back to that time, because we are told at the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD that they cut down every tree around Jerusalem. Of course, they would have needed it for all their siege works, fuel for fires. They would crucify almost the entire citizenry or a huge part of the citizenry when they finally took the city on every stretch of road that they could. And so there was all kinds of wood that would have been used. Everything was taken down. So nobody thinks these go back to then. But yet they're very ancient, and they would have the look of what we would think. All right. So the text begins then by saying to us that that's where he went. Judas came with a great multitude, we are told, in Matthew 26, verse 47 on your sheet. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. They most likely, of course, would have had the temple police. The man that headed that was always of the high priestly family. He himself would most likely become the high priest. We'll talk more about that in a minute, because it was not by death at this time that one succeeded to that position. Since Jesus had 11 at this point strong followers who might put up a fight, obviously we know Peter carried a sword. Who else did, we don't rightly know, but we know Peter will do what he thinks he needs to do at that situation. But we are told, John 18 and verse 3, all the scriptures on your passages are the New King James, but I'll read this one from the New American Standard. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort. So the New American Standard translates it that way because most likely that's what the word troops in the New King James means, that he not only had the temple police, but he had a Roman cohort. Now, if this is the entire cohort, that's a lot of men. We're talking about hundreds of men. It could be that it is something smaller than that, but nonetheless, they have come with a sizable force. In Luke 22, verse 52, and then Jesus said to the chief priests and the captains of the temple and the elders who had come to him. So even among these men now are some of the priests and some of the elders. Have you come out, he said to them, as against a robber with swords and clubs? Well, what preceded this, of course, is Jesus in the terrible agony in the garden. You don't have this on your sheet, but in Mark the 14th chapter, in verse 32, Mark says the most graphic words to describe what Jesus went through. And they went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. Those words just do not capture in English what the Greek is trying to say to us. The first word is a word that denotes a being in the grip of a shuddering horror in the face of a dreadful prospect before him. The second word is defined as an anxiety from which there was no escaping and in which there was no help and no comfort. So that when he says to them at verse 34, "My soul is very sorrowful even to death," remain here and watch. We need to capture what Jesus is going through. Here is where he will, as Luke said, sweat the great drops of blood. If that is a physical condition that actually can happen, that blood vessels near the pores break and so it becomes a bloody type of sweat that he would have dropped to the ground. When he is pleading with his Father to let the cup pass from him, and all of the Old Testament imagery of what that means, to drink the cup of God's wrath, to drink it to its bitterest dregs. When God would send his cup against his people, he said, "You will drink it until you stumble like a drunken man, until you are overtaken by your enemies." It was the idea that God has become your enemy, and he is about to exact his absolute and utter judgment against you. And so when Jesus is praying that, and he is sweating as he is sweating, and he is distressed beyond anything that we can imagine, we need to understand that his death throes, his process of knowing what is about to happen, has begun already. Here the disciples are slumbering. Peter, who said, "I'll die with you. Everybody else can forsake you. I'll die with you." And yet he comes back three times and finds Peter asleep and finally will waken them and say, "Let us go because the betrayer is at hand." When Judas comes, to pick up with your sheet again, he apparently comes well in front of the others, but not too far from them for them not to see the sign. We know that this is a full moon. At the time of the year when Jesus, at that time in 33 AD, would have been a full moon. So it had been easy to see the people who were coming, just as we think of full moons here and being able to see for fairly good ways. He would come and kiss him, Matthew 26:48. Now his betrayer had given them a sign saying, "Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him." And then immediately he went up to Jesus and said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and he kissed him. The Greek word here is kataphileson. Our word phileo, or their word, I mean phileo, our word for love, but the other word kata, the meaning down upon. That someone would grab somebody as they would in modern times too, to bus each other on the cheek in that part of the world. He would have kissed him, and that would have been a very normal greeting for a rabbi, as they would have thought of Jesus as being the rabbi of these men. But here it is an aorist tense that indicates, the commentators will say, you to kiss fervently, to kiss affectionately. And you can imagine that he has sold Jesus out. He has brought the people that want to put him to death to a place where they're not going to have to deal with the crowds of whom he is very popular, of whom he had come into the city at riding in on the colt, a foal of the donkey, and that they were shouting Hosanna to him and praise to God that he is the Messiah. They come now to get him in a place where none of those crowds are around and at time of day when none of them will be up. James Stalker writes in his Trial and Death of Jesus Christ, "But none can feel," speaking of the kiss, "its horror as it must have been felt by Jesus. That night and the next day his face was marred in many ways, furrowed by bloody sweat, bruised with blows, spat upon, and rent with thorns. But nothing went so close to his heart as the profanation of a kiss." When David would write in Psalms 55 of probably Ahithophel, "If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were raising himself against me, I could hide from him. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend, with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship as we walked with the throng at the house of God." If you have ever been betrayed by someone, if you've ever been betrayed, you know at least an inkling of how horrible a thing that is. To have trusted someone, to have put all your faith in someone, somebody that suffers at the hands of divorce or at the hands of children that should care for you when you're in your elderly age and honor and respect you. There's all kinds of scenarios we can think of. Traitors that have been in governments and different places. Can you imagine putting all your faith in someone and then they turn on you? The last person you would have ever thought would turn on you would be this person. How deeply your heart would be rent. How deep Jesus must have been rended by Judas. But he looks at him as he will throughout this whole ordeal, as we will look at time and again. It is Jesus who's in control, not these people. It is God who has brought all of this to pass. In Luke 22, verse 48, Jesus said to him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" There was no affection and nothing of that kind that was behind the kiss of Judas. And Jesus goes right to it. Well, he boldly confronts them. I suppose they expected him to run and to hide like you would expect most people to do if you saw that kind of force coming against you, to hunt you down in the garden like a cornered and frightened rabbit. But that's, again, not who Jesus is. Startled by him, they will absolutely and utterly be when he comes to them and he comes demanding who they are looking for. John 18 and verse 4, "Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, 'Whom are you seeking?' They answered him, 'Jesus of Nazareth.' And Jesus said to them, 'I am he.' And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them." I want you to note something at verse 5 of that passage. The word "he" is supplied by the translators. All right, it may well be that should be supplied by the translator, because you have to understand that's true. It could be supplied to grammatically be what it ought to be to us. But it also could be that Jesus is claiming what he had claimed all the time, to be God. When they come seeking him, the authority he's about to show in their presence, well, you'll see right now. "And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with him. Then when he said to them, 'I am he,' or if he just said, 'I am,' they drew back and fell to the ground." Now imagine, here are the ones who have come for him. Here are the ones who have come with all the force of clubs and swords and every other kind of instrument of that they had with them. And all of these people, and they fall back when Jesus says, "Who are you seeking?" There has to be more to Jesus as we look through this story than just thinking about him as being some man who has been caught by them. And he asked them again, "Whom are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said, "I've told you that I am he." Or, "I've told you that I am. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way, that the saying might be fulfilled which he spoke, 'Of those whom you gave me, I have lost none.'" Jesus' authority, as I've said to you, must in those moments have been extraordinary. In Mark 11, we are told that he came in twice. He would do this, at least we know from the account, once in the beginning of his ministry and once at this time, and cleansed the temple. They had made it a place where obviously people that would have to travel from all over the empire to worship at the feast could not carry animals with them like they had in ancient times when they just had to travel within Palestine. And so they would have to buy animals there to sacrifice. They would bring the money with them to do that. But they had turned the court of the Gentiles into a place to make profit, and it went to the high priest family and the different priestly families that existed at that time. There were about five main ones that we'll talk about in a minute. So they came to Jerusalem. Mark 11:15 says, "Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves." One of the accounts says that he made a cord of whips or something like the flagellum that's going to be used against him. And he goes just forcefully turning over their tables and striking them and forcing them to leave because, as he will say, he would not allow then anyone, verse 16, to carry their wares through the temple. And he taught them, saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of thieves?" And the scribes and the chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. Imagine one man going into a place like that and driving all of those people out, and none would come back and set up again. He wouldn't allow it. In Luke 9, we are told, as he was making his way from Galilee to Jerusalem, knowing that he would die and knowing that all of this was about to happen, it says that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. So much so that in Mark 10:32, the disciples were afraid of him. And they on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them, and they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. And he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them the things that would happen to him. And here they are acting like you and I would act, how all of us would be if we were to face that kind of thing. And yet Jesus is pressing on toward them, pressing on toward Jerusalem. He is the master of the situation, never the one who is on the defense. In Luke 22, verse 52 and 53, then Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness," because it had been given to them to do that to him. And so we are told that the disciples were not prepared for this. He had tried to prepare them. Matthew 26 and verse 40, he came to the disciples and found them asleep and said to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Whenever is a time that I read that passage, I do not think, if he brings judgment against us one day as a nation, will any of us be ready? Will any of us be ready to face what we may have to face because of his judgment? Let us watch and pray too, lest we enter into temptation. They lay their hands or try at that point to seize him. Peter draws his sword, of course, and strikes the miserable blow that he did. We say he got the ear, but he wasn't aiming properly for the ear. Now imagine if you had a Roman cohort there, what would their reaction be if somebody on the opposite side draws a sword and whacks somebody's ear off? You'd imagine like that, they drew their swords if they didn't have them out already. Just a very few seconds, and those men are going to be cut down or captured. All of this would have turned into a melee. In Matthew 26 and verse 52, then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus?" Peter, he says, "Die by the sword, everyone that takes the sword." Peter, there are 12 legions of angels that could come at my beck and call. One angel destroyed Sennacherib's mighty Assyrian army at the gates of Judah and Jerusalem. Peter, inconsistent with all of Scripture and the purpose of the Heavenly Father, poor Peter, as always is the case with him, thoroughly acting like himself, sticking his foot in his mouth, always being the person that was at the front. But if you look at this and you think there's kind of a rightness and a nobleness to what he's doing to try to defend his master, but as one man said, if he'd only been as prompt inside Gethsemane to do what Jesus told him to do as he was outside to do what he was not bidden to do. You and I can find the same kind of lessons in our own life. So everything for the disciples falls apart at that point. The only thing that remained was the instinct of self-preservation. Mark 14:50 says, "Then they all forsook him and fled." John 18:12 is not on your handout, but I'll read it. "Then the detachment of troops and the captains of the officers of the Jews arrested him and bound him." Isaiah writes of him in 63 and verse 3, "I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. For I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury, and their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my robe." He would be by himself. There would be no one to help him. Well, the ecclesiastical trial begins. There are three stages to this. The first is that he will come before a man named Annas. The trial that we will look at, of course, tonight is the one that matters, because that is the only one that can issue the death sentence, and that is the one before Pilate. Annas was 70 years old at this time. He had been invited by Herod the Great to come from Alexandria, Egypt, to Palestine. He was ambitious, able, arrogant. He was a Sadducee, and in the worst way, cold and worldly and greedy, intensely unpopular with the people. He had made himself intensely unpopular with the Romans. 20 years before this, he had been high priest, but the Roman procurator Gratus had deposed him because he had carried out executions without Rome's approval. But Annas had the high priestly family. There were about five of them that existed. And at this time, Herod the Great had banished the idea of death being the reason that a son succeeded the high priesthood, so that you had the office for a lifetime. Herod the Great had done away with that. It had become now a political thing. Yes, they were still of the line of Aaron, but they were appointed sometimes for no more than a year at the whim of the Romans and at the whim at first of Herod the Great. But Annas was so important, that family, that five of his sons would succeed him to high priesthood, and now his son-in-law, we are told, Caiaphas, was high priest at this time. And so John 18 and verse 13 says, "And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year." We don't know exactly where it was that they led him to. Probably Annas' house, but since we're in the middle of the night, most likely that would be the case. And the same, of course, we will know is true of Caiaphas. At verse 19 of John 18, it says, "The high priest then asked Jesus," this is Annas asking him, "about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said.'" And what you understand if you study the background of this is that Jesus is pleading to a law that they would understand they had to abide by. And that is, if you're going to accuse a man of a crime, then there has to be witnesses. There has to be, in a capital offense, two witnesses that agree, absolutely agree, in what they are saying. And that is, first, the charge must come from them, not that a man would bring, as we are protected in our country from bringing incrimination against our own selves by anything that we would say. The charges have to be brought from the outside, and that's what Jesus is saying to him. "When he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by," verse 22, "struck Jesus with the palm of his hand." Imagine if we watched a court case in this country and saw one of the guys, there's an officer in the court, go up and strike the accused on the face. We would know that we had descended into something we're not going to escape from. That it would be like the kangaroo courts of Stalin, when he just brought people that he wanted to kill before a court and condemn them. They were condemned before they ever had a trial. And so it's the same kind of thing you think here. "Do you answer the high priest like that?" And Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" Again, he is appealing to the law. It would say that the charges must be brought from the outside. And so because Annas gets nowhere with it, he sends him bound, we are told at verse 24, to Caiaphas the high priest. In Matthew 26, and I don't believe I had that on your page. In Matthew 26 and at verse 57, it says, "And those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered." Now that may have been why Annas was first doing what he was doing, because it was going to take some time to get the council together, the Sanhedrin, in the middle of the night. And this is the Passover. So they're going to be with each of their families doing what Moses said to do with the lamb and eating it throughout the night. And so to go get them and release them from their families is going to take some time. And Peter was following, as we will learn, at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest. So we know they come to his house. Going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priest and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. This is a panorama of a model of Jerusalem that is built in front of the Holy Land Hotel that's in Jerusalem. It is first century Palestine. You can see in the panorama what we talked about being the Temple Mount, where the temple would have been, the Dome of the Rock is now. None of these buildings, none of this on top exists. Of course, none of these houses, all of that. But they find, obviously, in the archaeological things, as we'll talk about, the arrow is pointing to where the Western Wailing Wall is now. Okay, so on the west side of the Temple Mount. This is the southern side of the Temple Mount. The double gates are the gates through which everybody entered into the mound. They would come up by a staircase and then come up level on the inside. They would enter in by the east side, always exit by the west side. So when they brought him from, remember, the Kidron Valley's over here, they would have brought him back into the city this way. This will also come to play in the morning because this is where the Sanhedrin meets, most likely where they meet, from what we can read in history. Today, this is what it looks like on the southern end of where we just saw the reconstruction of it. This is the city of David, what's part of it. On down here would be the rest. The double gate and the triple gate. They believe in the first century, both of them are double gates, but at some point later, these are actually the gates by which they would enter. They found the entrance for the triple gate here so that they would go up into the Temple Mount in that time. You can see if you can make it out here, the arches that have been walled in at some later date that would have been the gate, and they would have added at some point another one. But these are the remains of what are left of this picture. So what we were looking at was just on the other side of here. Over here would have been Gethsemane. They would have brought him back into the city. This is the upper city where the rich people live, where the high priest and all of their families. This is the palace of Herod, a reconstruction of it. The Agora, where it would have been the marketplace. We'll look at that tonight because that's when that will play a role. We don't know where he went in the city. This is a reconstruction of one of them that's typical. They would have had the open courtyards. They sealed these up, but these would have all been open. You would have just had the colonnades. And that's why Peter could look in and see what was going on, why Jesus could turn and look at Peter. They would have been out in the courtyard, but in one of these huge rooms. When the man that built this model lost his son in the 1948 battle against the Arabs where they secured Jerusalem for the Israelis, and on the very site where his son died, he bought this entire, opened up the hotel and built this in the 1960s. It is an amazing thing to look at. Of course, I've only seen pictures of it, but to think about somebody constructing all this. People criticized him that the houses could not have been this elaborate, but since that time they have excavated houses that were 6,500 square feet. So you can imagine how opulent that would have been. To think about that today is a pretty fancy house and a pretty well-endowed person. But in that day, they were filthy, filthy rich. So this would have been where all of the the priestly families would have lived, and this is where we are thinking about what is happening with Caiaphas. So how ought a trial to commence? Well, again, with a clear statement of the charges and the crime, but this one begins with the high priest, as we said, in Annas' case, asking him for what he has done. They call for witnesses, we are told, in Matthew 26 and verse 59 and 60. The chief priests and the elders, all the council, sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward. So finally, they find two that seem to agree. But verse 61 says, they said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Now, anyone could have known, if they had listened to Jesus, and even as John would explain it, that he was speaking of the temple of his body. He was not speaking of the literal temple. But we have to remember what that means to people back then. To desecrate any temple, Gentiles, the temples of Zeus, Aphrodite, whoever it would have been in their gods and goddesses, was a capital offense. So both the Romans and the Jews would have understood that this would have serious charge. And that a lot of leeway was given to the Jews in that regard if they accused someone of desecrating a holy place, of desecrating a temple, then that would be a death sentence. So we need to understand that. What is being brought here and being said would accomplish the thing they wanted it to accomplish. Mark 14, verse 58 says, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But not even then did their testimony agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But he kept silent and answered nothing. I suppose all of us putting ourselves in Jesus' place would immediately want to answer. Immediately we would think we're going to defend ourselves because this could end in a bad way, could end in our death. And most of us would speak up, I believe. But Jesus, knowing what is happening, knowing where it is going, remains silent against charges that, as we know, mean nothing. So the high priest then, after he has stood up in some kind of theatrical display before this council, the high priest at verse 63 answered and said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Son of Man was Jesus' characteristic way of referring to himself. It didn't carry all the messianic overtones that were prevalent in the first century. And they think of the Christ, the Messiah, as being a military figure who's going to kick the Romans and every other Gentile back into their homelands and will establish a kingdom like David's and Solomon's. And so Jesus apparently uses that phrase to take away anybody thinking it'll allow him to define it the way he wants to define it. And notice that he says to them, "I am not being judged by you. Hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power." And he means the glory of God. As the Scripture will tell us, he will go to and be seated after he has risen from the dead. And then he says, "You will see me coming on the clouds of heaven." So there are two Old Testament passages that he is referencing. Psalms 110, verse 1. "The Lord said to my Lord," remember he asked them, how could David write this? "The Lord, Jehovah, said to my Lord," David wrote, "sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." There would be no one. You remember that Joshua brought out all those kings and had the captains of thousands come by and put their foot on the neck of those Canaanites before they killed those kings. To, again, in an ancient way, show that we have overpowered you. We are the masters of this situation. God's Son would reign at the right hand of the power. And then Isaiah 19, verse 1, one of the passages in the Scripture where the burden against Egypt, "Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at His presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst." I think more about growing up in West Texas and seeing a thunderstorm coming on the horizon, you know, climbing thousands and thousands of feet into the air. And just, you know, we used to talk about it. If you could see green and the black, you knew you were in trouble. Dale smiling because it was going to hail, and it was going to hail badly. And you see that kind of a powerful storm coming. That's the idea that is here. God, Jesus is looking at him and saying, "You're not judging me, but I will judge you. And you will answer for all of this." Then the high priest tore his clothes, Matthew 26, verse 65. "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy." Matthew 26 and verse 66, "What do you think?" And they answered and said, "He is deserving death." And they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ. Who is the one who struck you?" Mark tells us in chapter 14, 65 that they blindfolded Jesus and then struck him. The reason for that is they believed that Isaiah 11, verse 3 was a passage written about the Messiah and that he wouldn't need sight to identify anybody. He only needed smell. "He shall not judge by what his eye sees," Isaiah 11, 3 says, "or decide disputes by what his ears hear." He could just know his enemies. And so that's why they blindfold him and strike him. It's like further proof to them he can't be the Messiah because he can't even fulfill this passage. And all the while this is going on, out in that courtyard is the nefarious deeds of Peter. It goes from one person who challenges him, a maid, and you are a Galilean, you were with him, and he denies it. And Jesus had told him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny three times that you know me." And here's the most powerful passage in Luke 22 and 60. Remember, this is an open courtyard. They can see each other wherever he is. "Man, I do not know what you are saying." Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Then Peter went out and wept bitterly. The madness of what he was doing melted away. You know, there ought to be pain in us when we sin. I mean, we ought to acknowledge it when it happens to us, but imagine if Jesus were to turn and to look at any of us in our sin. That the thing that would cut us to the core is not just our sin, but what we did to Him and how we nailed Him to that cross. And so we end then thinking of them at some time in the early wee hours of the morning, one of these houses being Caiaphas, making their way back to the temple where they will have the official council assemble. They will most likely enter it by what's called Robinson's Arch. It's still on the mound. You can see it, but they know a staircase led into the area where is called the Stoa. It was built after the Greeks. It was, we are told by the Babylonian Talmud, where the Sanhedrin moved 40 years before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So just about the time of Jesus on their earth is where they moved. And then this is looking at it from the end. Somewhere when we look at the story of Jesus Christ and think of His death upon the cross, somewhere in that crowd of people, we find ourselves. We may be more than one of those people in our reaction to Jesus and how we treat Him now even. If we've not obeyed the gospel, why? Do we not believe He is who He claimed to be? Maybe we mock Him as they did. Maybe we think this is all ludicrous and that the Bible is a fairy tale myth. But somewhere in that crowd that was there is you and me are there. We are those people. We nailed Him to the tree. And the Scripture says to us that He came in order to do that so that our sins might be washed away by His blood. If you're subject to heaven's invitation this morning, Jesus said, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned." We can help you come to Him. We bid you come as together we stand and sing.